From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Tens of thousands of L.A. teachers are off the job this morning. They're striking over salaries, class size, and support personnel. This is the first time in 30 years L.A. teachers have gone on strike. Schools are open with administrators and substitute teachers, and our KPCC reporters are at schools and district headquarters. We'll have the latest after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
So here we are on a rainy day in the richest country in the world. In the richest state in the country, in a state as blue as it can be, and in a city rife with millionaires, where teachers have to go on strike to get the basics for our students. Here we are, in a fight for the soul of public education.
That's Alex Caputo-Pearl, United Teachers Los Angeles president, at a news conference this morning, kicking off the first LAUSD strike by teachers in 30 years. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, our usual politics roundup, delayed until the second hour of the program, we'll revisit the record-setting partial government shutdown and the expanding field of Democratic presidential candidates. But first, picket lines are up at LA Unified campuses throughout the district. Tens of thousands of teachers are striking for higher pay, smaller classes, and additional nurses, librarians, and counselors. The district claims there aren't sufficient funds to meet the demands of United Teachers Los Angeles. LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner spoke this morning to CBS 2 LA.
We've said repeatedly that we want to do everything we can to keep school open. We did not want to strike. We want many of the same things. We'd like to reduce class size. We want to make sure we have more counselors, nurses, and librarians in schools. But we've been unable to reach agreement because we have limits of what we can afford to do. The county has come in and told us that we can't spend more. So we're spending every nickel we have in schools. I went to Sacramento last week to talk to the governor and his staff, to talk to legislators to get more funding for our schools. We've been working with the county for more funding for our schools. And every nickel we have, we're putting into our classrooms.
That's where we stand right now. And of course, for parents, the difficult decision over whether to send their kids to the classroom today or not. For some parents, there aren't other good options. So even if they'd prefer not to cross picket lines, dropping off their kids nonetheless at school today, for other parents who do have alternatives, making the decision as to whether they'll keep their kids home or send them to school. With us is KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. He's at Reseda Charter High School in the San Fernando Valley. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Larry.
So how active are the picket lines there at Reseda?
Not a lot of picket lines right now, actually, Larry. A lot of the teachers' union members are beginning to make their way, at least this morning when I was at a different school. I was at Daniel Webster Middle School on the west side. A lot of teachers said that they were going to start making their way down to the big rally that the teachers' union is having this afternoon near City Hall. So I don't see any picket lines outside of the front gates of the school here. Maybe that is the reason why. But I'm actually here because this is one of the schools the district has opened to show to the media to see what's going on inside schools during the day today. So there are a couple hundred students in the auditorium here, but I just to get in the building, the plant manager walked me through a dark hallway of a campus building that one would imagine is normally bustling with students at this time of day. So definitely an impact here on campus.
And Kyle, I was wondering, because it's Reseda Charter High School, right? So even the charters, some of them are affected by this?
Right. Charter is a weird word in this context, because there are charter schools in Los Angeles Unified that operate under the label of charter, but that some of the most ardent supporters of charters would call charter schools in name only. And so this is it's a charter school, and it operates under some of those provisions, but also operates essentially as a district school. And this is one of those. This is a district high school with some of the charter,
autonomy. So but the teachers are UTLA members.
Right.
Okay. And there is a march that's scheduled for 10:30 this morning from L.A. City Hall to the headquarters building for L.A. Unified on Beaudry Street. If you had a chance to find out in your visits this morning, Kyle, whether significant numbers of teachers are looking like they're going to take part in that rally and march.
Well, as I said, the teachers at Daniel Webster Middle School, where I was at this morning, were set to head out there this morning from the west side. So they were going to fight traffic to get out there. So I would imagine that is sort of the plan. And just having visited two campuses this morning and now seeing no picketers visible here on this other one, I haven't been to every entrance. So it's possible there's just somewhere else that I haven't seen. I'd imagine that attendance is going to be big. I'm curious to know just, whether or not rain has dampened attendance. But I did see, several dozen, members of the teachers union out picketing this morning at Daniel Webster Middle School. And so, it's possible maybe the rally is today's main event.
Kyle, when you were at Webster, was it possible to determine how many students were showing up, or were you there too early? Were you there before kids would be coming?
There were a trickle of students coming in and arriving near the school. It's difficult because, there are several schools actually on the campus of Webster Middle School, and this is one of the issues the teachers are striking on is co-located charter schools. They want to put more regulations on this, but there are charter schools that share that campus, not like this one, like quote-unquote real charter schools that share campuses there. So it's difficult to say whether those were charter students. It was very respectful. Students were walking by the kind of a thin line of teachers that were picketing over a pretty long stretch of road and no conflict that you can see. But here at Reseda Charter High School, this is a school of about 1,500 students. There may be a couple hundred students in the auditorium here. So definitely a significant decrease in the normal attendance.
We're talking with KPCC reporter Kyle Stokes. He joins us from the Reseda Charter High School in the San Fernando Valley. Also with us, KPCC reporter Prisca Neely, who is at Grand Park, where the rally is scheduled for 10:30 with a subsequent march from Grand Park in front of City Hall to the district headquarters building on Beaudry. Prisca, good morning. I know there's still more than 15 minutes before the rally starts, but how does attendance look so far?
It's very impressive. It's not raining at the moment, but it was a few minutes ago, and it is a sea of red down here. Red ponchos, red sweatshirts, red umbrellas as UTLA's members stream into the park. I don't know if you can hear the chanting behind me, but there are people flooding off of the subways, the metro stop here at Grand Park. There are cars walking by honking and showing their support for the teachers. I had trouble even parking because most of the public parking lots in this area are over capacity.
All right. And right now, the district, by the way, holding a news conference, talk about what's going on. And we're kind of dip into there and hear a bit of what's going on with that. Was scheduled for 10 o'clock, but apparently it has not yet started. So as soon as we have details on that, we will pick up on that and hear what the district has to say. Have they announced who the speakers are going to be in? I'm wondering, whether there's going to be some star power at the rally today, Prisca.
No, I don't know that. I'm just trying to kind of make my way down.
Invitation. Thank you.
Now, and the rain is just starting to pick up again. A lot of people out here have laminated signs. One I'm looking at now says, "Sorry for the inconvenience. We're just trying to save public education." The rain has started up again, and everyone's kind of putting up their umbrellas, but there are thousands and thousands and thousands of teachers out here.
Wow. We're talking with KPCC's Priska Neely. She's at Grand Park, right in front of City Hall, where thousands of LA Unified teachers, the union was hoping, would show up. And it sounds like strong attendance thus far. The event doesn't even schedule to start for 15 more minutes. And then that march to district headquarters. Priska, I was also wondering about what the plans are once the strikers get to district headquarters. They talked about what they're planning to do once they arrive.
I'm not sure on that. I do know that many teachers are planning to go back to their school sites after that march and are planning to be there once school lets out around 1:30 or 2 o'clock. So they're planning to return to base. So a lot of driving around for these teachers today.
All right. We're talking with KPCC's Priska Neely at Grand Park. Kyle Stokes also with us from the Reseda Charter High School in the San Fernando Valley. And I'd like to hear from you if you're a parent of an LA Unified student. What did you decide to do today? Were you able to make alternate plans? Are you keeping your children home? Or have you taken them to school either because you don't have a good alternative and you need to work, or you had a possible alternative but thought it was better to have your child go to school as per usual? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, KPCC.org. Also, if you are a teacher at LA Unified, I'd be interested to hear what your experience has been. Were you out on the picket line at your campus? What sorts of interaction, if any, did you have with teachers or with any of the replacement personnel coming into work on your campus? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPCC.org. A chance for you to share with us what you're experiencing. I'm not asking you to make sort of the case for one side or the other. We certainly have had the debate over the issues that are at play. Those have been quite consistent. I'm interested in the experience, the interactions that you've had out there at the campuses in the district today. I'm also interested in your thought process as a parent and what that's been like for you coming to a decision. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. And apparently, the picket lines are going to be on hiatus at the school from 9 o'clock until 2 o'clock today. So at the typical drop-off point for parents from 7 to 9 this morning, and then from 2 to 4 this afternoon, teachers will apparently not be picketing, or at least not scheduled to picket the schools, between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m. today. Kyle, had you heard about the limited hours of picketing?
Yeah, we knew that there was going to be a strike, a march and rally, and that was going to be a significant event. I was not aware how many people were going to ship out to that, previously, because I've been covering mostly negotiations at this stage and haven't paid quite as much attention to the logistics of this. Certainly you got the impression, as I was mentioning before, with teachers talking about we're going downtown at 9 a.m. And the fact that I'm here on a campus right now without picketers visible, you get the impression, and just from hearing what Priska is saying, my gosh, it sounds like a lot of people down there, that's a huge issue.
Kyle, are there any scheduled negotiations or nothing at all that's planned at this point?
Not at this time. The union had said they were not going to be available for negotiations today because all of the members of the bargaining team, the negotiating team, are going to be doing, these events that they have scheduled out at this march, as well as their dignitaries in town. The leaders of the two largest national teachers unions are here to show their support. So they're going to be busy with that. The union had previously said there's no practical way for negotiations to take place today. And, absent some news coming out of the press conference that I haven't been able to attend, obviously, or to listen to from the district, I am not aware of any development on the negotiation front so far today.
All right. KPCC reporter Kyle Stokes with us. Priska Neely also joining us. Let's talk with Emily in downtown Los Angeles. I understand you're both a teacher and a parent. Emily?
Yes.
I teach in Southgate, but I'm driving in downtown right now. We're trying to get over to the rally. It's super crowded down here. It's been really encouraging. Most of our teachers are on the picket line. We did have one teacher who crossed the picket line. Most of our teachers are there.
All right. And the TA, the assistant who crossed the picket line, was that person spoken to by members of the picket line?
Well, no. All of our TAs had to cross the picket line.
All of them. Okay.
By the union.
Okay.
One teacher crossed the picket line.
Okay.
But yeah, none of our PAs are protected, so they had to be on campus. We're still supportive of them, but they're letting us know inside that we had about a 25% attendance rate, which is really good.
Was there a confrontation with that teacher that crossed the line?
There was some confrontation. You know, we really respect him, but he's basically being told lies by the district about his retirement, and it's really affected morale in some sense because we really like him. But, you know, you can only do so much to convince people. The district's going to tell a teacher something, and we're telling them another thing. So there's only so much you can do.
All right. We're going to now dip in. Austin Buettner speaking live.
Governor, with the mayor, with the state superintendent of public education, because it is our desire to have all of our educators well-supported back in schools serving the needs of our students. I will reintroduce Board President Garcia. We have a few family members here today who wish to comment briefly on their own perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. We know that our families are absolutely urging all of us to conclude our business on this negotiation. I'm going to introduce three women who will share the impact this today is having on their families. I want to start with Jerry Guzman, a grandmother from our organization. Thank you.
You're listening to a live news conference that the LA Unified School District has put on. As you just heard, they're going to have family members talk about the challenge of not having teachers in the classroom today. And obviously, we've heard from many of the teachers over the course of the past few weeks that if they're not going to be getting additional support and smaller class sizes, they're going to strike until they get the kind of support that they say they need in the classroom. Again, I welcome your input as teachers are preparing for a rally and a march in downtown Los Angeles, and then with picketing scheduled to resume this afternoon. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation in just 1 minute. For the first time in 30 years, there are picket lines at LA Unified campuses. This morning, teachers were out in force. The plan was to have teachers on the line at large numbers of LA Unified campuses. And now with the downtown show of union solidarity, the march planned to district headquarters, and then the picket line coming back this afternoon. Good to have you with us on Air Talk as we speak with parents to find out what the family impact of this is. Also, if you are a UTLA member, I'm interested in what you saw at your campus this morning. And I'm also curious if this strike is a prolonged one, how you're going to be handling that with your family and the loss of income during the time that teachers strike. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Carrie in Studio City, good to have you with us. I understand your daughter is an LAUSD student. Did you send her to school today?
No, I did not.
Okay. And what went into your decision on that?
We strongly believe in class size reduction. We don't want their class sizes to increase because the kids get less attention from the teachers. We're also anti the cohabiting of the charter schools with the main campuses. So we wanted to be standing alongside our teachers in front of the schools, and we're headed down right now to LA. We strongly are supportive of our teachers and our education system.
And how have you, what year is your daughter in school?
My daughter's a senior, and one of my concerns about not sending my daughter to school is that they had said absences would count against the seniors in high school and the eighth graders in middle schools. They said the kids may not be able to be in the graduation ceremonies. So us as parents, we rallied together and we said, hey, if they're not going to let them be in the graduation ceremonies, then we'll just hold our own. We'll have a private graduation ceremony. It's not going to stop us.
All right. And Carrie, what's your sense of other parents? I mean, did you meet with other parents or just, you know, talk to them informally about what they were planning to do as well?
Ahead of time, we had parent support groups get together. We have a parent supporting teachers Facebook page. And so we kind of got together and communicated with each other. And then down in front of the school, we just started talking to each other. And then as kids were getting dropped off, we were talking to the parents, kind of, you know, saying, hey, you know, you don't have to do this. You don't have to send your kid to school, you know. And some of the parents got together ahead of time and were offering up their homes to have, you know, kids stay at each other's homes so that the working parents didn't have to, you know, look for childcare for like the younger kids, the ninth graders, and same with middle school. So,
all right.
We're supporting the teachers and parents are supporting parents. So,
all right, Julie, I appreciate it. Thank you. I'm sorry, Carrie, thank you for sharing your experience. What school does your daughter go to?
She goes to the Los Angeles Zoo Magnet, which
is
part of North Hollywood High School.
Yeah, very good. All right, Carrie, thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Miriam in Glassell Park has the very same concern, said, my son is in high school and I'm worried with him being out of school during the strike that it could affect his admission at college because they'll see the absences on the schedule. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. After the parents spoke at that LA Unified News Conference. The news conference came to a close. So the district wanted to have parents come in, talk about what hardships it would create to have the teachers out on strike. Of course, we're also hearing from parents here on Air Talk, talking about the experience, how they're planning if their child isn't going to school or if they are going to have their child go to school, how they're dealing with that. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page. Julie in NC. Sino, good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. We kept our kids home from school today. We marched at the picket line at our elementary school. All the teachers, all the special ed teachers were out striking. I went onto the campus just to see how many kids seemed to be in the auditorium, and it looked like our school only had about 35 kids out of roughly 315 that were attending today.
Wow. So just over 10% of kids showed up at the school. And you said they were all in the auditorium, at least to start?
They were in the auditorium. They said they'd be splitting them into two classrooms today.
All right.
What I was told.
Okay. And how many kids do you have at this school?
I have one kid at this elementary school, and I have another child at a middle school. And we're home. Both of the kids are home today.
Now, did you have to change your work schedule to be able to accommodate them being home?
Thankfully, I did not.
Okay. It sounds like the vast majority of parents, 85 to 90%, chose to keep their kids out today. Did you have any conversations with your fellow parents about the lengths to which they were going, particularly for the elementary school kids, so that they'd have someone with them today?
You know, it's hard because we were talking amongst ourselves. We had email chains and text chains going. And some parents are in the position to maybe stay home with their kids and strike for just a day, but not for the duration. And so they have tough choices ahead of them. But those of us who are home indicated that, you know, we might be able to help for a day or two. We're all trying to kind of make it work for us and for our community.
And how long, if this strike lasts weeks, for example, are you going to be able to provide the care during the course of that time, or you have to come up with some other arrangement?
I can provide the care, but it's the education that concerns me. I mean, we'll strike for the duration. My kids and I will walk the picket lines for the duration, but We understand that the end of the year will be here before you know it. There is testing. There is standards to be met. And that definitely is a concern. But the immediate focus is to have UTLA's demands met.
All right. Thank you, Julie. I appreciate it very much. A parent of two LA Unified students, Julie, joining us from Encino. Again, I'd like to hear from you, your thoughts about day one of the strike and what you're seeing on your particular school campus. The reports we're getting so far are that the overwhelming majority of students are being kept home today, at least on some campuses. Now, I wonder at some of the campuses in lower income communities where there might not be any sort of alternative for childcare, whether kids there are in much higher numbers being sent to their local campuses. Again, I welcome hearing from you what you're seeing in your community. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Right now, in downtown Los Angeles' Grand Park, looks like thousands of teachers have turned out for a rally to support day one of the strike and a march that is planned from City Hall to the headquarters building of LA Unified on Beaudry Street. After that rally in March, then teachers, many of them, will be back on picket lines at their campuses starting at 2 o'clock this afternoon. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'd like to hear from you if you did send your child to school today, what you saw at your child's campus, and whether you felt comfortable with what you saw or whether you would be rethinking sending your child to school tomorrow. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Pippi writes on the Air Talk page, seems to me that keeping kids out of school or forcing them to cross picket lines contradicts the it's for the children that we always hear. Lisa writes on the page, our daughter, who is a high school student, does not want to cross the picket line, and we support her. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Angriest in LA says, anyone talking about how stressful this is for the children? And I'd like to hear that. I'd like to hear from parents what your kids are going through, how abreast of the issues they are that are involved in the strike. Do they have a good grasp of the issues that are at play? Is it something that interests them, the issues that are involved with the strike? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. It takes me back to when I was a student at LeConte Junior High School in Hollywood, and the teachers were in some particularly difficult negotiations with the district. And the teacher in our social studies class was laying out the union position. And because I'd kept very much up on the issues of the strike, I offered some of the points of challenge to the teacher about the union's position, which she didn't take too kindly to us. I remember 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I just wanted to make sure the other side was heard. That's important part of the educational process, not just one side to the story. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And when we come back, we'll talk to our reporter, Priska Neely, who's at the rally right out in front of City Hall at Grand Park, downtown Los Angeles. And we'll hear what's going on. We'll get a bit of a guesstimate on the size of the crowd there. Last time we talked with Priska a few minutes ago, it was not raining downtown, but we'll get more details to come. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and we'll get the latest update coming right up. Also want to let you know, 1A with Joshua Johnson in Los Angeles today and tomorrow, broadcasting their shows from KPCC both days and holding a KPCC in-person event tomorrow night at the Skirball. Putting on also a special show just for KPCC listeners. That's at 2 o'clock this afternoon, an exclusive show, 1A, just for KPCC listeners. A look at what it's like when major sports events come to L.A. That's coming up this afternoon, 2 o'clock, a special broadcast, L.A. only, of 1A with Joshua Johnson. Just saw their team out in the hall as they were doing their live show across the country from here earlier today. We'll be back on Air Talk, hear from more parents and teachers after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Day one of the strike involving the LA Unified School District, UTLA, the teachers' union, calling for the strike to start this morning. Teachers were on the picket lines at hundreds of LA Unified campuses. We're hearing from parents and teachers, and right now, the UTLA action has moved to downtown LA, Grand Park, at City Hall, where thousands of teachers were expected for a rally followed by a march to district headquarters on Beaudry. KPCC reporter Prisca Neely is there at Grand Park. Prisca, describe for us what you're seeing now as we're about 10 minutes into the rally.
Well, Larry, if there's a program going on here, I don't know about it, and a lot of other people don't know about it. It is so packed. It is hard to even make it through the first level of Grand Park. But there are a lot of different chants that are going on in different pockets of the park here as people are huddled under their red ponchos and red umbrellas. Right now, I am huddled with a fourth grade teacher and some of her students and parents in their classroom. And we're hearing just a ton of different chants from education is a right, some very creative signs that teachers are making, one fish, two fish, support our schools. There are a lot of people down here, and it's really hard to move.
Well, how close were you able to get? Where are you standing right now?
Right now, you know how Grand Park has the multiple levels leading down to City Hall?
Sure.
Down to the second level, and I can see some tents set up in what looks like a program. I can also hear some, what sounds like a band playing. I saw some people with some large brass instruments earlier, but haven't been able to actually make it down to the platform because there's so much commotion going on.
Wow. So it sounds like a very big turnout. Now, you said Yes. You have a teacher that is there. Share with us who you've been speaking with.
Yes, her name is Amanda Sharon, and she is here, as I mentioned, with her daughter, who is a graduate of LA Unified and now in college, but also a parent, one of the parents in her class, and some students from her class. So I can go ahead and...
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to speak with Amanda.
Ask her some questions.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Hello.
That's KPCC reporter Prisca Neely, and now we're talking with Amanda Sharon. Amanda, thank you very much for being with us. Where do you teach?
I'm a teacher at Los Feliz Elementary School in East Hollywood.
All right. Were you on the line there this morning?
I certainly was. Every single teacher at my school site was on the line, and we're all here downtown in the pouring rain.
All right. So no one crossed the picket line on your campus?
No one crossed the picket line. And in fact, very few students showed up because the parents support us, and the parents don't want their children crossing the picket line either.
And did any of the parents share with you the lengths to which they went to be able to have their kids cared for and not go to school today?
I'm sorry?
Did any of the parents share with you about the challenge of being able to take care of their kids today?
Ah, yes. Well, you know, most of the parents Well, some of them are actually here with us today, but a lot of the parents are keeping their children home if they have a place that is safe for them to be with someone there watching them. Also, the Parks and Rec have opened up their doors to us, and there's all the museums are open. So a lot of, on the metro on the way here, we met a museum worker who said it's going to be crazy at the museums, but it's going to be crazy fun.
All right. And has the rain had much of an effect? Doesn't sound like it's had a huge negative effect on turnout.
I think there would be more children with us. I think the parents that are walking the line with us today, they went out and bought special raincoats for their kids. But once the rain stops, I think all the parents will be joining us with the kids.
Yeah, good day for poncho sales. Looked like everybody in the picket lines on TV I saw this morning were wearing rain ponchos. So a good day for vendors who have that. Amanda, just personally for you financially, if this goes on for weeks, do you have some sort of contingency for the loss of income?
Well, not exactly, but I know that California Credit Union is offering teachers loans at like 1% if it's paid back within 6 months. I personally am okay. I've been in 28 years as a teacher, so I have some savings that will support me for the next couple months.
Okay.
But I know that there are teachers at my school site who are worried about even paying February's rent.
I'm sure. Thank you so much, Amanda. We appreciate you sharing your experience. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for asking us.
All right. Prisca, just before I let you go, so it sounds like the program's going on there and then the march to follow at that point. Have you had a chance to get any other details from the teachers that are there?
Details about our different marches?
Yeah, or just about their attitude about being there, supporting the strike day one.
Oh, we're all happy to be here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought Prisca got the phone back. I'm sorry. All right. That's all right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. That's Amanda Sharon, who's an elementary teacher, Los Feliz Elementary School, joining us. Let me go to caller Wayne Johnson, who was UTLA president back when the last strike happened in 1989. Wayne Johnson, thank you very much for joining us. So you having a feeling of deja vu?
A big feeling of deja vu, Larry. but I totally support what the teachers are doing, and they're simply standing up now for, I think, what has to be done at this point to save public education in Los Angeles.
So you think the district will be able to come up with the money necessary to increase the numbers of support staff and lower class size?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. They've got nearly a $2 billion reserve. Plus, the other problem with the district, Larry, is that it's the way the school district spends their money. When I was president back in 89, there was one administrator for every 12 teachers. Now there's one administrator for every 9 teachers. If you had only one administrator for every 25 teachers, like you've got one teacher for every 35 students, there'd be plenty of money to fund all of the necessary programs that the kids need to really improve their.
Of course, as you well know, there's much more administrative burden that school districts have to take on today, particularly for an urban district, Los Angeles, with all the special needs students, all the students who have special programs. Managing all of that compliance is a huge task and bigger today than it was 30 years ago when you were UTLA president.
Well, that's true to some degree, but still, the district bureaucracy is so bloated at this point. You just can't defend it by saying that all these paper pushers are absolutely necessary to keep the school district running. The teachers in the classrooms with the kids generate all the money that the district takes in, and when that money does not go back to that classroom, but it goes out to all these various offices to fill out all this paper. That's an absurdity, and it's really the cart before the horse.
Wayne Johnson, I don't remember how long the strike lasted back in 89, but first share with us how long it went, and then what the biggest challenge was for you with your membership back during that strike.
Well, it lasted 9 days, Larry, and the biggest challenge that you have and it's going to be a challenge even today, is that people go out because they're very angry and they're very upset. But when you get out on that picket line and all the uncertainty is out there, you're not getting paid, and I guarantee the district will start claiming that they're going to cut off their medical benefits and all those kinds of things. Then the trauma begins to set in. How long am I going to be out here? And so you have to have issues that to keep them out as well until you can put enough pressure on the district to settle. And the focal point for us in 89 is that our elementary teachers struck in very high percentage numbers. And those elementary schools were full of kids with no teachers. And that was the pressure that really forced the district to give us a 24% pay raise over 3 years and pay for medical benefits for retired teachers, that kind of thing.
Wayne Johnson, thanks so much. Nice to have you call in and talk with us about what it was like 30 years ago, the last time UTLA strike, the LA Unified School District. Wayne Johnson, former UTLA president. As we continue, we'll take more calls from parents, from teachers, from others. I'd like to hear from you how you made the decision as to whether you sent your child to school today at an LAUSD campus, and if you didn't, how you were able to make alternate arrangements. Tremendous challenge in working households to be able to do it, and particularly if the strike goes on and on, going to be an ongoing challenge in many households. We'll take our listener calls as we continue 1 minute from now on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're hearing from members of the LAUSD community. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Kelly in Englewood. You're not only an LAUSD parent. Kelly, I understand you're a product of LAUSD schools like I am, and you were a student during the 89 strike. Is that right?
Correct, Larry. And so a lot of my feelings regarding this strike are influenced by that strike. During the strike in 89, I was a ninth grader, 14, and a lot of the language that the teachers were saying was that it was about the students and they were doing this for the students. And it just seemed like to me that after the strike ended and they were back on campus, that it didn't seem like it was about the students. They got the concessions from the district, and, you know, it was kind of business as usual. And I don't think they took into account what impact the strike had on the kids. And so I made a decision to have my kids go to school. And for me, it was really about refocusing the argument about, you know, you hear all this language and see the signs stand with teachers. It's about the students. And I don't hear enough of that. I did see a lot of the picket signs that say we're standing with students, but that just seemed kind of like a line or kind of, you know, something really good to say. But the focus and all the language, at least from what I've seen, has really been about the teachers. And I think we need to get back to this is about the students and what does it mean for them.
And if, you know, of course, the UTLA leadership, they've argued that the class size inhibits, you know, students' ability in the classroom and not having support, you know, personnel at the levels they think is needed is also a harm to students. But Kelly, I'm curious, how old are your kids, first of all, and did you go to school with them this morning?
I did. My kids are 8 and 11.
Okay.
My oldest goes to middle school, and because I have two drop-offs, I wasn't really able to go in with him, but I told him to keep his head high and that as a student, nobody should be saying anything to him and to let me know if anybody did. But my youngest, I did walk in with him.
All right. And did you have any conversations with teachers as you crossed the picket line?
I didn't. A teacher did give me, try to give me as I was talking with another parent a sign, and it was really about my son. And so I didn't say anything, and I went in, and I just have I really resent that the language is about crossing the picket line when we're talking about kids, and they're either facing absences and truancies, and they're caught in the middle.
Kelly, did you get a sense of what the attendance was at the middle school and the elementary school where your kids went?
The middle school, I didn't, but the elementary school and the kids were split, with the younger kids were off in another room, but it was significantly down. I hesitate to guess. I would say no more than 20% of at least the upper grades were there, but that's just really back of the envelope.
Kelly, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. So Kelly was a student back in 89 in middle school when the last strike took place, and now a parent of two L.A. Unified students. Let's see, Veronica and Encino. I'm short on time, Veronica, but I briefly want to hear your experience. You have a special needs student, is that right?
I do. He's in 10th grade, and we thought we'd give it a try. He did want to see, you know, he's, you know, loves his teachers, loves the school, but, you know, he wanted to go to school today. He's nervous. You know, he's a rule follower, doesn't want to miss school. And like some other callers have talked about, you know, we're worried about what absences would mean for him. But he's in a large auditorium with lots of other kids. He doesn't have his resource teachers or his counselor available. And we will not be sending him for the rest of the strike. It's just unacceptable.
So then you've got to deal with the emotions your child has about not going to school, which so one way or the other, it's certainly a parental challenge for you, Veronica.
It's no win. We're all at an impasse, right? I mean, but he's called and texted me three times already.
All right.
And I know that the administrators that are working with them, I really, you know, like them at the school. He's actually at Reseda Charter High School.
Oh, same school that Kyle is at, yeah.
Right, exactly. And it's a wonderful school with wonderful teachers and wonderful leadership from the administration who are on campus today. And I know that they have reached out to him, but it's not enough.
Veronica, thank you for sharing your experience. I appreciate it. Also with us at the LA Natural History Museum is Take Two producer Emily Henderson. Emily, thank you for joining us. Have there been much of a turnout of parents or kids for the special program at the museum today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing a pretty steady stream of parents with school-age kids, a lot of strollers and umbrellas coming through. Because the museum is letting LAUSD students in for free today because of the strike.
That's great. And what have you had conversations with any of those parents or students so far?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of parents and students. The younger kids seem pretty excited that they get to come and look at the dinosaurs instead of going to school today. I had one little girl tell me that she thought her teachers were awesome and she totally supported them, especially because she got to be at the museum today. But I also spoke to a sophomore in high school who was kind of frustrated that she was missing class. I mean, she's at a point where her GPA is important to her and she's not in class today. She's at the museum, you know.
Yeah.
It's a sort of mixed response. Parents are saying, you know, that they stand with the teachers and they're just trying to do what they can to make this day productive for their kids since they're not in class.
Emily, what's the museum doing? Are there special tours or special programs? What are they doing to engage the kids?
You know, I don't know if there's anything particular going on today because of the strike. You know, I could see the posters up for some 3D movie shows that are being shown here, but I don't know if that's just something that's, you know, happening for the season or if it's something because of today.
Yeah, I'd heard that some of the museums and some of the libraries, in fact, were doing special programs aimed at kids who would be off school with the strike, whose parents didn't want to send them to school. So, well, it sounds like it'll be a fun day for some of those kids who were able to go to the museum and don't have to go to school today. Emily, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Yes, thanks, Larry.
Emily Henderson is Take Two producer joining us from the Los Angeles Natural History Museum in Exposition Park. Coming up at the end of Air Talk, we'll have another check-in on what's going on in that big gathering at Grand Park, downtown Los Angeles, where UTLA holding a rally for teachers, then a march to follow to district headquarters on Beaudry Street. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Day one of United Teachers Los Angeles strike against the LA Unified School District.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Terrific to have you with us. Just want to remind you that coming up at the end of this hour, we will revisit what's going on with day one of the LA Unified strike. Teachers right now meeting in Grand Park, downtown Los Angeles, for a rally and march to district headquarters, with more picketing expected at local campuses this afternoon. Right now, we turn our focus to national politics and the biggest stories that are going on in D.C. and across the U.S. We're in a historic partial government shutdown, never before going this long, more than 3 weeks in length, and the impasse, of course, over funding for a border barrier that President Trump says is essential before he signs any continuing resolution to fund the government. We've got confirmation hearings that are scheduled to start tomorrow for President Trump's nominee to be Attorney General, William Barr. And there's an early release of some of his comments in what'll be his opening statement tomorrow morning. Also, Rod Rosenstein reportedly set to leave either after the confirmation of Barr or after the Mueller report is turned in. Pick your news source as to when he's going to be leaving the position as Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Joining me to talk about the latest issues, Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Lonnie was an advisor for the Rubio presidential campaign of 16, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, with us as well. Matt, your thoughts on the impasse? Any light at the end of the tunnel on the impasse over funding?
I'm not getting any younger, and my wife keeps telling me my eyesight is getting worse, so I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, but maybe somebody with better eyesight can see it. No, there just doesn't seem to be any incentive on either side. You know, the shutdown to me is sort of a microcosm, politically at least, of Trump's approach from a political and a kind of electorate point of view. If you looked at the recent poll, there were some CNN and Washington Post polls out this weekend, and the numbers are bad for Republicans. It was like 53% or so are blaming Republicans for the shutdown. They're blaming Trump. Not surprisingly, he said he would shut the government down. He did it.
And said he would gladly take the blame.
And he would take the blame, and now the voters are giving it to him. And if you look at independents and women are overwhelmingly blaming the Republicans for it. But what's also interesting in there is Republican support for the wall, though, is increasing, as is its intensity. And so it's up to something like 87% support and 70% strongly support. So this is the exact dichotomy that we've seen. Trump is 1,000% base strategy politics, and it has trapped his Republican. Everyone, you always hear the media. I always like laugh. They're like, "Why don't Republicans just quote stand up?" But everyone is quote unquote stands up, whatever that means. It's sort of a thing you say when you're on CNN or MSNBC. But whoever stands up gets sort of demolished, and it's the same thing. And that electoral strategy and that political strategy had real negative consequences for Republicans in these past midterm elections. We don't know where it's going to stand for 2020. But it really is a microcosm, which is I'm going to go 100% for this idea that no one really agrees with, thinks it's a dumb idea. But if you ask most Republicans, they think it's basically a dumb idea. But Democrats look at these numbers, say, we're not going to move. The president, this is how he's operated from day one. And Republicans are kind of caught in the middle. And so I've always thought we're all kind of living in Trump's world right now, and we're just going to have to wait and see how he plays out. But I don't see how this gets resolved right now, because neither side seems to think there's a reason to move.
Yeah. Well, and then you look at Mitch McConnell, who sort of represents that sort of traditional Republican perspective. Yeah. He's just sort of on the sidelines during this whole thing. It's like Trump with his supporters standing behind him against the Democrats.
Well, I'm sure his members are looking and saying, my gosh, women and independents are overwhelmingly against this. This is bad for me as a senator. But again, you look at it and say, well, if I come out against Trump, though, I don't need to worry about the general election. I'm going to get primaried and get bounced out of my seat as it is before I even get to the general. So it's a challenge. If you're a Republican senator, this is a very difficult place to be.
Lonnie Chen. Lonnie, good morning. What is the potential way out here?
Well, good morning, Larry. I don't know that I see a way out, in part because the politics of this, I think both sides see as playing to their advantage. I think the Republicans, certainly for President Trump, his view is that, if he's able to continue to drive this issue, it's going to raise base approval, and that's going to be important for him as he heads toward 2020. On the part of the Democrats, I think it's also the case that because you have the increasing influence of the progressive left, what you see there is a sense amongst Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer in the Senate that if they hold firm to this point of view, that they're not willing to give Trump any money for the wall he wants, that this will work ultimately to their advantage. And it's important for them to drive up that base support as well, certainly to satisfy that part of the party, which is ascendant. So I think both leadership in the Republican side as well as the Democratic side, they both see this as working to their advantage. I think as a result, there isn't an immediate solution to me politically. Now, from a policy perspective, of course, there's a very elegant and easy solution to this, which is that each side gives a little and gets a little bit. There's
that
some
like
funding
compromise.
For,
that's suspiciously.
I know.
The
bizarre,
C word, Lonnie.
it's a bit like a unicorn, maybe. Not something that you're likely to see in this day and age. But to conclude the thought, I think if, for example, Democrats were willing to give a little bit and provide some money for a, let's just call it a physical barrier or some kind of a physical mechanism, whatever you want to call it, in return, for example, for a permanent solution to address the recipients of DACA benefits, those undocumented immigrants brought here when they were young children, which, of course, has been the subject of a lot of controversy. But quite frankly, I think both people on the right and the left believe it's a good idea to furnish some kind of status for these folks. That kind of deal, I think, would have overwhelming support were it ever brought to a vote. The challenge, of course, is that President Trump doesn't necessarily want a deal right now, and I don't see Speaker Pelosi or Leader Schumer wanting a deal either.
We're talking with Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution. You hear his radical idea there, compromise.
Yes, Larry, what kind of guests are you getting on to Air Talk so now? Extreme. Compromising the American system. This is outrageous.
Yeah. And Lonnie, I wanted to ask you about where is E-Verify in all this? Holding business owners accountable for hiring people who have documentation and are legally able to work. It seems like Republicans have totally dropped E-Verify.
Yeah. In fact, interestingly enough, Larry, there's a strain within the Republican Party, let's call it the Rand Paul strain, that believes E-Verify is got this sort of big brother element to it, which in fact they don't actually like. Now, most Republicans, I think, would still say that they support E-Verify. One of the ironies of this partial government shutdown, of course, is that one of the departments affected is the Department of Homeland Security, which assists in the processing of E-Verify requests. And so what you actually have are employers who are trying to certify that the employees they're hiring are in fact eligible to work in the United States. And because of the partial government shutdown, that process has slowed down significantly. So I still think E-Verify is a great idea. I think it's an important part of an overall immigration solution, but it has gotten caught up in what has been a very toxic discussion on immigration policy generally.
Senator Lindsey Graham has called for President Trump to declare a national emergency and to take dollars allocated elsewhere to use for a border barrier. And the president was asked this morning before leaving for New Orleans for the American Farm Bureau Federation whether he's still considering declaring a national emergency.
I'm not looking to call a national emergency. This is so simple you shouldn't have to. Now, I have the absolute legal right to call it, but I'm not looking to do that because this is too simple. The Democrats should say we want border security, we have to build a wall, otherwise you can't have border security, and we should get on with our lives. The Democrats are stopping us, and they're stopping a lot of great people from getting paid. All they have to do is say we want border security. That automatically means a wall or a barrier.
Matt?
Sounds like a lot of room for compromise in there. I see it. You know, Graham had also talked about potentially opening the government for 3 weeks while they negotiate some of these issues. And then if they can come to agreement within 3 weeks, then you're on. Or if not, declaring a national emergency. The problem with declaring a national emergency, I think, is twofold. One is substantive, which it's going to create all sorts of legal challenges. It's not clear, one, that there's a real emergency by the definition of it. So whether he can or can't do it is going to cause a whole firestorm legally. Whether the Trump administration wants to go down that road, that's an issue. And then I think there's a political one, which some of his members of his own caucus aren't going to be too crazy about that, because I think they look at that and say, well, what happens if a more progressive president gets in there? They're going to start declaring all kinds of national emergencies for one about climate change, one about wildfires that are happening in places like California. So there need to be emergency measures taken around reduction of carbon gases or something. So I think there's a political element to this as well, which is why it's also difficult, as usual, and we say this all the time, it's hard to follow the president because he's now said about 35 different things in the last week about a national emergency. He's going to do and he's not going to. He has the legal right. He's just going to let it play out. So we never every day seems like it's a new idea of whether it sounded like last week during his speech, they were leading up to saying he is going to declare a national emergency. Then 5 minutes before the speech, said, well, he's not going to do it. And then he barely even said anything during the speech. So it's always very hard to follow where Trump is in this because he's so schizophrenic in his language.
Tomorrow, confirmation hearing begins in the Senate for Attorney General nominee William Barr. He released today, or the committee did, his opening statement for what he's going to tell the senators tomorrow. And he said that he would do nothing to interfere with the Mueller investigation. And furthermore, that he thought it should be made public whenever the report comes out from the Mueller team. Matt, just real briefly, yeah. Do you anticipate there's going to be much of a hurdle for his confirmation?
I don't. Well, we said that about Kavanaugh when we went into the hearing. Probably not. Republicans control the chamber. There are a lot of questions about him. I think Democrats are going to be aggressive about questioning him, but there does not, as of now, at least seem anything overtly problematic that's going to derail his confirmation. He'd already served in this position before. So I think there's some questions about the memo he wrote against Mueller. I think there are some questions of what he would do if and when the Mueller report comes out. But I don't see anything from a macro point of view that's going to stop him.
Lonnie, do you concur?
I do. I concur. I think he'll be confirmed. I do think that we'll see, some testy moments during the confirmation hearing, certainly around the question of whether he would pledge to protect Bob Mueller, for example, from firing by the president. But no, I don't think it's going to result in any change to the outcome, which is he will be confirmed.
Lonnie, there was a New York Times story a couple days ago claiming that the FBI considered investigating whether President Trump was compromised by Russia and essentially doing the bidding of the Russian government after he fired James Comey. This would seem to feed into the narrative that many of the president's supporters have, that the FBI was overstepping, looking to try and undermine a newly elected president. Your response to the Times story?
I think we see this story through the lens of how we feel politically. Obviously, for the president and his supporters, they view it as the deep state, so to speak, coming back to figure out a way to subvert and undermine the president. And if you oppose the president, you see it as evidence that even law enforcement believes that the president was somehow compromised by his ties or alleged ties to the Russians. I think the reality of this is that I mean, the big question here, of course, is to the extent that Rod Rosenstein knew or did not knew, or was he sort of said told something differently? I have a very difficult time believing that someone like Rod Rosenstein at a very senior level wasn't implicated or involved in agreeing to potentially have an investigation of this sort, or at least read into the fact that such an investigation was happening. So the question then becomes, you know, was Rosenstein complicit in what the FBI wanted to do, or in fact, was he sort of told something else? And by the way, there's also reporting out about the president not wanting notes from his meetings with Vladimir Putin made available to staff or to anybody else at the White House even. And I think stories like that serve to raise additional questions, obviously, about the president's ties to Russia. And that's why this stuff continues to get traction, is because you have this reporting that comes out that suggests the president wants a friendlier relationship with Moscow. And the question, of course, is why.
Well, and Lonnie, do you think the FBI, I mean, is it free to just launch an investigation into an American president? And what are the risks involved in doing that, as opposed to having, you know, some sort of a public process for an investigation like that?
Right. Well, I highly doubt, as I noted, that the FBI would simply freelance, or that senior officials at the FBI would freelance and launch an investigation without the knowledge or certainly the approval of senior officials at the Department of Justice, most of which many of which are political appointees. So that part of it, to me, I'd find it troubling if there was some kind of investigation launched without their knowledge, if it was some kind of secretive investigation into not just the president, but into any senior government official without some kind of a check from somewhere. I'd think that'd be deeply problematic. But like I said, I have a very difficult time believing that no senior official, and by senior I mean very senior official at the Department of Justice, knew that this was happening, or in fact consented to it in some shape or form.
Quick thought on it, Matt.
Yeah, well, Lonnie picks up a lot of, and your question really goes to the heart of this, which is the stakes are really high for this Mueller investigation, obviously, but it's really not just for Trump. We've talked ad infinitum about that, and that is going to be the central focus. But there's a lot of institutions that are on the hook here. So there's a lot that the FBI has done that normally I think Democrats would be very progressively very nervous about. And this going all the way back to the J. Edgar Hoover days. And people are kind of cheering it on because, well, Trump by definition must be evil. But I think we're going to really want to find out if there's something not legitimate here, that the FBI was either wiretapping or doing some of these investigations. Who authorized that? Why did they authorize that? Where were the Obama folks in all of this? I do think there's a historical and some institutional importance here to figure out what actually happened, because this can if they're kind of freelancing like the Trump folks think they are, and I'm like everybody else, it's hard to believe a lot of what the Trump folks are saying. But this is, you're talking about investigating a person who's just won the presidency of the United States. Who authorized that? Why? What was the real evidence beyond? We just see a lot of smoke and mirrors right now in the press. But I think this could be deeply problematic. And there's a lot on the line for the FBI here, the Justice Department, the Obama administration, and all those officials who were involved, obviously, in addition to Trump and, you know, with whatever they were doing in the campaign. So the stakes are getting higher and higher here as we learn more of what steps were taken on both sides relative to the election of Donald Trump.
That's Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Lonnie Chan of the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He was an advisor to Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign. We'll continue our conversation. Many more important topics for us to get into, including Syrian troop withdrawal that began last Friday. And we'll also talk about the Democratic field of candidates for 2020 becoming more robust by the day. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in a minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking with Republican strategist and fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, Lonnie Chan, and Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Let's turn our attention to another important topic in politics, the withdrawal of U.S. forces beginning last Friday. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on a reassurance trip, as he's calling it, to the Middle East. Lonnie, your thoughts about what Pompeo might be able to accomplish, as well as the concerns that the withdrawal from Syria has for the Kurds and other U.S. allies there.
Well, I mean, this has been a very concerning period of time when you think about policy in the Middle East. Certainly the concern about the president's desire to precipitously withdraw troops from the region, I think, has been voiced by a number of Republicans as well as a few Democrats. And I think that the reality is it's a very difficult region to deal with. This was one of the black eyes of foreign policy from the Obama administration, in my mind, was their inability to process a cogent policy in Syria. And certainly the president, by moving to precipitously withdraw, I think has only furthered that trend of not having a real coherent strategy with respect to what to do there. And part of it is because it's very challenging. You've got a lot of different figures involved, some of whom are trustworthy, some of whom appear not to be trustworthy. And the challenge, of course, is that there are a lot of interests in the region who would love to see the United States gone. Certainly the Turks, there's been some discussion of President Erdogan and his conversations with President Trump on this topic. And so the problem is not just what the situation is vis-a-vis the Kurds in Turkey now. The problem more broadly is are we leaving a vacuum for ISIS, for example, to redevelop in the region? Are we leaving a vacuum for radical Islamic terrorism to gain a foothold again? And I think notwithstanding some of the tumult or walking back the administration has done in terms of explaining the policy, obviously the notion of not having U.S. engagement in the region is deeply troubling.
I want to also talk about Brexit, where another big vote is scheduled amid conversation that maybe there'll be a referendum on the Brexit vote from before. Obviously, Theresa May's leadership has had a huge setback in the initial inability to get that out of Parliament. Matt, what are the repercussions on the U.S. with the Brexit problems in the U.K.?
Yeah, well, there's a few. I mean, there's many. There's obviously just the economic piece, which is what happens if Britain finally does do this, whatever this looks like. And this has been such a sort of arduous process. Are they going back to have another referendum? Are they just going to get out? Or, you know, it doesn't seem like anyone kind of knows what's going to happen. So there's just the obviously it's a large country, has a huge economy, and is one of the leaders in Europe. So that's part of it. What does this do to Europe, which is an enormous economic bloc? I think there's some political ones too. You know, if they go for another referendum, there's going to be a real question. Is this gets back to the larger democratic issues that are going on. There's been some talk about, well, maybe we need to re-vote on this. And that could be that has its own potentially problematic elements. You know, the voters voted one way. It seems like, you know, there's a lot of bureaucrats trying to push them not to leave. That's exactly what led to Brexit to some degree in the first place. And we've seen strains of that over here, a distrust of institutions, elites versus kind of, quote, regular folks, whatever that means. It's a larger, longer show. But I think all that politics is roiling over there. And that's some of the politics that's roiling over here. May's been in a horrendous position from the get-go on this thing. Has never really 100% come out which one way she's really leaning on Brexit. She's trying to just like sort of get them over the finish line. So I don't think we really know. We're going to have to see what happens with the vote tomorrow, and then we're going to have to see what course they decide to take. But this is an enormous political and economic upheaval that is we're potentially on the cusp of. They don't really figure this out. And I don't know what figuring it out means, because I don't know if anyone really knows what that
means. Well, and it's another deeply divided country over this issue.
Well, and it's actually typical. If you watch a lot of the elitists, there's a lot of – you listen to some of the more – if you listen to the right-leaning podcasts or commentary, it's on one direction. If you listen to the left, it's like, well, all those people who voted for it, they don't. It's all going to hurt them, so they don't really understand they're voting
if
against themselves.
If only they knew.
And that's your classic kind of, if only those like those sort of Philistines understood what they were doing. And so it's a very similar kind of dynamic here, which is your sort of the center of London, which is in one direction, and everybody else around the country seems very upset about the whole thing. But it's not dissimilar to sort of the rural-urban divide that we're seeing here.
Yeah, Lonnie, I know you got to run, but quick thought on Brexit and the upheaval in the U.K.?
Well, this is exactly the challenge, is that now if what this ends up going to is some kind of additional referendum, people who voted to leave the European Union are going to be remarkably upset. And this division in European politics and British politics that we're seeing, very similar to what we're seeing here, as Matt pointed out. So I think we're probably going to end up with a no-deal Brexit. I think that Theresa May is under tremendous pressure to deliver that. But by the way, she's probably the best positioned. I don't see what the alternative is. It's certainly not another leader. And I can't imagine that they would want to put her through another leadership challenge, given that she's already been through one here in the last few weeks. So we'll see what happens. But it's got an impact on the U.S. economy, to be sure. So it's something we should all be watching carefully.
Lonnie, thanks so much. We appreciate it. We'll talk with you again soon in the coming weeks.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Lonnie Chen of Stanford's Hoover Institution. Matt Rodriguez will continue with us as we talk about the growing field of Democratic candidates for president. Former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro announced on Saturday that he is running. Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii announced on Friday that she is a candidate for president. And we expect U.S. Senator from California Kamala Harris, who's on a book tour right now, will likely in the coming week or so announce that she is a candidate for president. Matt, this field is going to be massive. Yeah. And it's notable how many, House members are considering because that's something we haven't seen as much of in this country. Typically, it would be senators or governors. Yeah. Or business people.
I think it's – or Donald Trump. I think it's Garfield. Was it 1880 or something was the last House? I'd have to look up my history. But, I worked for Dick Gephardt for years. When I started in politics, I just started almost 25 years ago back in the 90s when he was the House Democratic leader. He was there before Nancy Pelosi took over as leader and eventually speaker. Clinton was president. And he had run – when he was a youngish guy in 1988, he was in his mid-40s.
Yeah.
He won the Iowa caucuses, ran out of money after he came in second in New Hampshire. Dukakis ended up becoming the nominee that year. But the point is it was sort of an audacious and a House member running. You just weren't taking that seriously. And he obviously went on to have an impactful, obviously, a long political career. There are more House members. Some of it – it's always – when you run for president, there's a variety of things you need to think about, right? Now, Trump, I think, has given, some permission – and we'll see if a guy like Garcetti or there's Mayor Buttigieg in South Bend, Indiana, or Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans. There's clearly people who think, well, if he can win, anybody can win. So we're in a different political time. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a huge star. Like, there's a variety of ways to become famous in a way that it wasn't before, which was sort of going through, your Democratic, or Republican party and over time rising to a level of some national prominence.
Yeah, Joe Biden, a prime example.
Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, Bob Dole, they're around for a long time. They tend to all lose, by the way. So you do have a lot of House members looking. You have people with not a lot of experience. I think some of them are thinking they can catch lightning in a bottle. Some of them are also thinking, look, if I could just say I ran for president, that might put me kind of in another realm. Now, there's also a flip side to that, which is you can really embarrass yourself or have things come out from your past that are really problematic, which actually derail your political career. But I think for some of them, they think there's a moment happening now. I want to be in on this moment. And that's why I think you're seeing everybody from, you could be announcing in the next week or
yes,
so, and I wouldn't be surprised.
Shh,
so
don't tell me.
I mean, keep it quiet.
Yeah, there. You couldn't pay me enough.
Yeah, believe me. I know.
You're close enough to the sausage making.
I know how bad it is.
Yeah. I do find it fascinating that you've still got these very age advanced guys who are really the only ones known on a national level. So you're looking at Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. Joe Biden. These are the guys that finish atop the polls because they're the only ones that everybody knows who they are.
That people, and this is really typical of early primary voters. You're just going to Jeb Bush was leading by a lot when he started out. When we were running against Hillary Clinton back in 2008, I was on the Obama side. She was up. Iowa, New Hampshire tends to close quickly because the candidates are there a lot. But the rest of the country, they're, unless you're watching MSNBC or Fox every day, which, by the way, you should do something different with your life. You're watching that every single day. But no, she was up 30, 35 points everywhere by definition. People just don't know who you are. And over time, as the campaign moves on, you get elevated. So I'm not, of course, Biden's, he's been around for 45 years. The challenge for those types of candidates, especially on the Democratic side, is that your high watermark when you start? And is there only any place to go but down? And I think Joe Biden has an enormous amount of experience and brings a lot to the table, but he does run the risk, and so does Bernie, that their best day is going to be their first day. And that's something that you have to fight against.
So then the challenge is you have all this, the rest of this field that essentially starts out pretty equal.
Yeah.
I mean, Elizabeth Warren has a higher profile because she's been in Congress
but she has higher negatives, which is also a problematic for
But
her.
She has more name recognition,
correct,
for example. But a lot of the other folks, like even here where Kamala Harris is known, California, junior senator, but outside California,
no one knows
not
her
as high. Yeah.
No.
So kind of everybody below the old guys, you know, start out equal. Yeah. And how are they going to be able to distinguish themselves?
To separate this? Well, that's what they're talking about now. So you're really where you are now is, and having gone through this several times, they're really in the staff and donor primary now. So they have been lining up for a couple of years. They always give the kind of, I haven't been thinking about it, but they've been thinking about it for a long time. You're doing two things. You're trying to line up your consultants and staff. You want to have, because it's hard. There's so many candidates running. There's just not that many people have been through the process. And that's why I do think Bernie has some advantage, at least to start, because he's got battle-tested staff. And running is not just a matter of saying, I have one run on campaigns. It's getting ballot access. It's dealing with the New Hampshire activists or the Iowa activists, or how do you approach
highly
some of these
specialized
campaigns. It is specialized work, and it's hard. So that's what you're spending the first – and saying, can you raise the money? And what's my path? And you've got to go to those donors and say, here's why I think I can win, from a demographic perspective, from a policy perspective, from a money perspective. So that's really what they're going to spend the first 3 or 4 months doing. But the really next question really quickly is going to be, how do I separate myself in a field? Because as you saw with the Republicans in 2016, obviously Trump became the dominant story. But Cruz had a little bit of a moment, and a few of them kind of, Carly Fiorina had like a 2-week moment.
And Rubio got in trouble trying to have a moment where he sort of became Trump-like and had a huge backlash.
And embarrassed himself. Now, a lot of that was Trump was uniquely Teflon-like and problematic in terms of fighting. But you're right. But that's what I'm talking about. I think Rubio did himself a lot of damage. He was looked at as a rising star. He's now – no, look, he's back in the Senate, and that's fine. But his star – I think you would have said, had he come in second place in a normal – maybe Jeb Bush had beaten him and he had run a credible campaign. You said, that Rubio, he's in his early
40s. So young.
So good looking. It's all going to happen for him. Maybe he's going to be a vice president. Maybe he goes into the cabinet. But after that, with his sort of his little hands comment and all that other stuff, I don't know whether he's a viable presidential candidate again in his career. So that you have to be careful about that.
Matt, thank you as always. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
Good to be here.
Democratic political strategist Matt Rodriguez with us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the Detroit Auto Show. And the automakers are debuting a bunch of flashback, reprisal of models. We're going to talk about why they're going back to some of the models that have previously been discontinued. And I'm going to ask you, what car model that's been discontinued would you like to see revived? 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page. Back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. In just a few minutes, we'll check in with the very latest on day one of the strike. United Teachers Los Angeles, the union striking against the LA Unified School District. Right now, rally and march to district headquarters, and then the picket lines reactivating 2 o'clock this afternoon at local campuses. Coming up on Fresh Air, transplant surgeon Joshua Mesrich about the excitement of his job in transplanting organs and changing people's lives. His new book, When Death Becomes Life. That's Fresh Air with transplant surgeon Joshua Mesrich coming up. And then at 2 o'clock, a very special KPECC audience-only broadcast of 1A. We don't want you to miss that, with host Joshua Johnson. He's in the house today to talk with Los Angeles listeners about how LA sports fans prepare for big national events, Super Bowls, All-Star Games, Olympics. We got a bunch of them that are coming. We'll talk about the logistics and the experience of that. It's 2 o'clock, the exclusive LA-only broadcast 1A with Joshua Johnson right here on KPCC. But right now, the Detroit Auto Show is getting underway this week. And one of the fascinating aspects of it are how many old, discontinued models of car are making comebacks this year. With us from CNET, editor-in-chief at Roadshow by CNET, Tim Stevens. Tim, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, what's driving this revivalist trend among U.S. car makers?
Well, there's definitely always been nostalgia in cars. There's always been a big throwback to those major marks that the car models that maybe people aspired to when they were younger, but they weren't able to pick up. And so a lot of these cars that people really wanted to buy for a long time, but maybe have been too expensive on the used car market, are now making a circle back. Things like the Toyota Supra, for example. We have a new one of those that's been unveiled today. Ford's got a new Bronco coming, and the Ranger they're bringing back to the market too. So cars that people have fond memories of, they're making a comeback.
And I'd love to hear from Air Talk listeners, what car that's been discontinued, would you like to see come back? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. The previous Supra, when was that discontinued? The early 2000s? That they stopped making
it? Right around the end of the 90s was when that car was discontinued. Okay. Yeah, but of course, it had a huge comeback in the Fast and the Furious series. It was one of the hero cars in that series, and so people are eager for that thing to come back for a long time.
Yeah, great, great car. It's going to be a high horsepower, high performance model, just like the old Supras?
It will be, but a lot of things that people don't realize about the old Supra is that it was actually more of a kind of a luxury touring car than a straight-out performance car. But everyone kind of tuned those things so much, that car was so often modified that it turned into this kind of high horsepower racing model. This one's got a little bit more of a touring character to it. It's actually very similar to the BMW Z4, upon which it shares the same platform. It'll still be fairly high horsepower, 335 horsepower, but quite expensive, starting at about $50,000.
Wow. Okay. Now, you mentioned Ford's bringing back a couple of vehicles. What are they looking to sort of exploit in the market as a part of those new models?
Well, Ford's got both the Ranger and the Bronco coming back to the market. The Ranger was unveiled before, and that's coming to the market pretty soon. The Bronco, we're going to have to wait a little bit longer on, but the Ranger was their compact pickup truck that left the market because they saw enough people buying the F-150, the full-size truck, that they didn't feel like they needed to have that compact truck anymore. But with the success of the Chevrolet Colorado and other compact and mid-sized trucks like that, Ford decided to bring the Ranger back. So we're getting that coming back to market this year. And again, it's throwing back to a truck that was, for a lot of people, their first truck. You know, the Ranger had huge popularity, especially in the 90s and in the 2000s. And Ford wants to bring that back. And then, of course, with the Bronco, that's a legendary nameplate. And, compact SUVs are incredibly huge right now. So that's a great opportunity for Ford to capitalize on that market.
And the Bronco was still a good seller when they discontinued it. Was that just the fallout of the OJ chase?
It definitely was. And ultimately, there was a huge turn against SUVs with gas prices going up, and that certainly didn't help the market either. But with new technologies making those SUVs lighter than they were before, and with new internal combustion engines and forced induction and things like that helping for fuel economy to be better, you can actually drive a car like that without having a lot of the compromises of fuel economy and efficiency that you did before. And certainly, as we've seen, people love being in something that's a little bit taller. And there are very few crossover SUVs that really have character. And of course, the Broncos always had great character, great styling, and that's something that we're looking forward to coming back in the market again.
Again, I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. What discontinued model car would you like to see revived? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. For me, it would be a car I don't think we'll ever see return. The 1958 Cadillac Eldorado Biarritz convertible. I love that car. The thing is, wouldn't even fit in a lot of garages, but just a knockout of extreme, was it Harley Earl design of huge fins on that car. And I just love the look of that. An over-the-top vehicle, but just absolute piece of art going down the road. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Michael joining us from Boston. What car would you like to see revived?
Hi, I lived in L.A. for a while, so I know this might be heresy, but some people don't basically like cars. We just want to get from one place to another, and there are a lot of young people who have trouble getting remunerative work, and so the Volkswagen Beetle, something like that, safer than it used to be, of course, probably not nearly as easy to fix, and if it could be made electric, particularly good.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, an electric Beetle. There'd probably be a market for that. Michael, I appreciate it very much. Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, the Beetle actually is a car that's just going out of production. They just took it out last year. But of course, when the Beetle came back, it wasn't, the low-cost attainable car that the Beetle was originally. And it would really be great to see the Beetle reborn as a low-cost, attainable, practical EV. I think that could be great for VW.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tim, Chevy's bringing the Blazer back. Is that going to be like the old one?
It should be. We're still waiting on the details of exactly how hardcore it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be quite, you know, the body-on-frame off-roader that it was before, but it certainly should still have some good off-road characteristics to it. And again, we're hoping that it'll have enough good styling to kind of, you know, make fans of the series happy. And that's the big thing that Ford has to do with the Bronco, and we hope that, that Chevrolet can do that with the Blazer as well.
Ray in Atwater Village, what car would you revive? What model?
My first car as a teenager, a 1961 four-door Chevy Corvair, pretty infamous for being unsafe at any speed.
Yeah, yeah. But what's funny is how much of a collector car that's become.
Absolutely. That was my first car. I paid $500 for it, and I loved it. It was spacious, modern-looking, and I guess unsafe.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem is how you bring back a model name of a car that has negative associations. We'll probably never see another Edsel, you know, for example, or Pinto. Tim, I mean, are certain names of models just so poisonous to the manufacturer they can't use it again?
I think so. And also, of course, those are very common sedan nameplates. And right now, you know, the trend is to move away from sedans. So there are very few sedans coming back to market. The majority of things we're seeing are coming back as a crossover. And we're even seeing some former sedans and even sports car names that are being applied to crossover SUVs. For example, Mitsubishi the Eclipse was a very common compact sports car in the 90s. Now that name is being applied to a crossover SUV. And so a lot of the fans of the Eclipse are a little bit unhappy about that. So we are seeing some missteps as these manufacturers are trying to kind of tap into some of that that fan loyalty.
Let's see. Mark writes on the page, the AMC Pacer, Matador, maybe the Gremlin, going way back to some derided cars of the 1970s. Ralph says the Honda Civic Wagon, closely followed by the Toyota Tercel Wagon. Those were great cars. Many still on the road offer loads of utility and reliability combined with excellent mileage. I was never really sure why these companies discontinued the models, but it later became obvious the makers were all too eager to offer scads of gas-guzzling SUVs in their stead. But the hatchback, it seems to me, Tim, has sort of taken that station wagon space.
Definitely. Hatchbacks are still doing okay. Some of those are moving away. For example, the Ford Focus and the Fiesta are moving out of the U.S. market. Those are some of the most common and most popular hatchbacks that we see on the road today. But both of those are being discontinued or already have been. But certainly, you know, the compact crossover SUV can really be seen as, in some ways, a tall station wagon, effectively, just like a lot of SUVs are a little more than kind of chunkier minivans. But, of course, people don't want to think about that when they're buying those cars. So that body shape does sort of live on. But by and large, as we're seeing, people want a little bit of a taller car. And so that's making it difficult for these manufacturers to bring a hatchback like that into the market. But companies like Volvo and Subaru are still doing very, very well at selling those cars.
I just want to update our listeners that teachers are on the move. They are marching now from Grand Park towards the LA Unified District Headquarters on Beaudry. We'll get a live report momentarily. But Max in Burbank, what car model would you revive?
I would bring back the Honda Element. I have one that I've had for over 10 years, and I love it. It's sort of weird, but incredibly functional.
All right, the Honda Element, Max. Thanks so much. Kitty in Redondo Beach, which car model would you bring back?
The old Nash Metropolitan.
Cute little car.
Very cute. And a friend had one that was yellow. We drove around in it. We called it Lemon Drop. But it was a good gas mileage, it was cute, it was compact, and it looked so much nicer than the, you know, the little Fiat or whatever. It just had more style to it.
Yeah. Kitty, I appreciate it. Yeah, and we saw, for example, the Mini Cooper make a comeback, and I wonder, Tim, will we ever see a Nash Metropolitan come back?
I don't think we'll see a Nash, unfortunately, but yes, we did see the Mini Cooper come back, and the Fiat 500 is back on the market as well, and the Abarth is actually a really nice car to drive. Nash might be a little bit more complicated legally, I think, to bring that back, but certainly was one of the most iconic cars of the 50s and early 60s, and yeah, beautiful, beautiful car.
Have to acquire the copyright, I guess, to that. Nick, in Hollywood, what a previous car model would you revive?
I would like to see, Larry, the Volkswagen Thing.
The Thing, yes.
The Thing, right. It was such a fun, a lot of surfers had it. It was a big California car because it would fit the surfboard and nothing electric. So the top would come off manually. So you'd have a Volkswagen convertible. And it's such a fun car, certainly only for the summer. You wouldn't want to have one on the East Coast. but a delightful car to have in good weather, the Volkswagen Thing.
I remember when I saw the first TV ad for the Thing, I thought, how in the world is this going to make it? It's so unusual, this sort of, transforming vehicle. But Tim Stevens have seen it. They obviously found an audience.
Absolutely. And the use value of those things is actually remarkably high. They're really climbing in a big way, which actually is a pretty good indicator that maybe Volkswagen would see that and think about bringing something like that back. And again, it kind of fits into that sort of SUV template. So they could apply that name on a crossover SUV and it wouldn't be too out of bounds. And they are actually, playing with some of their nostalgia-based things. They're bringing back basically the microbus as the ID Buzz, which is an electric bus. And so it wouldn't be surprised to see them take that same basic foundations and apply it to a couple of different things. And it'd be great to see an all-electric thing.
Priscilla in Pasadena says, I'd bring back the Ford Escort CX2, a small car, but ran beautifully. Mine has over 217,000 miles on it, still runs like new. That's Priscilla in Pasadena. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. We'll continue. You can weigh in with car models you'd like to see revived, because at the Detroit Auto Show, there are quite a few comebacks, including the beloved Toyota Supra is coming back, a high-performance vehicle. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. While we're talking cars, just want to mention to you, Pacific Coast Highway closed because of a mudslide near Broad Beach Road. Caltrans working to clear the mud off the roadway. Residents will be allowed in with their identification, but PCH closed near Broad Beach Road because of a mudslide. We're talking about car models you'd like to see revived, as there are a number of revivals taking place at the Detroit Auto Show being announced. Let's talk with Colleen in La Puente. Colleen, which models you want to see come back?
The Dodge Demon. I had a 1971. It was a slant six engine. It was easy to maintain. I have a son that has seizures. It got to the hospital many times over. It ran good, but parts were hard to get, so I give it up.
Yeah, Colleen, thanks so much. Tim Stevens of Roadshow by CNET. Was the Demon much of a seller in the early 70s?
It was a very limited car, but they did actually bring it back in very limited numbers just a couple of years ago, actually. And the Demon was the name that they applied to their incredibly high horsepower drag-based car, the first production car to do 10 seconds in a quarter mile out of the showroom, basically. But that was very limited numbers. They sold 1,000 here in the U.S. last year, and I think 300 in Canada, and that was it. So the Demon was brought back from hell, I guess, as it were. But but that's the end of it now, unfortunately.
Return from the underworld. John in Pasadena, real quickly,
exactly.
Which revival would you like?
The 1993 Toyota MR2. It's a mid-engine car. And it runs like it's on rails. My mom had one for 20 years, and when she went to sell it, I bought it off her. I said, we got to keep it in the family.
All right, John. I appreciate it very much. Julie writes on the page, in Britain, I loved 50s and early 60s Wolseley's Morris Minor, and have a nostalgic fondness for the Hillman Minx. All right, Julie, thanks very much for the British cars. We appreciate it so much. Hey, Tim Stevens of Roadshow by CNET, we're your editor-in-chief. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been really fun talking about which models you would like to see revived. Now, let's do a quick check-in. The latest day one of the strike, LA Unified Teachers Against the District. Joining us, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, anything new to report from where you're at in the Valley?
Well, I've just got sort of a look at what's going on at Reseda Charter High School today, kind of behind the bars. The teachers are not here. They are, as we've been reporting this morning, down at the big march in Grand Park and heading up to district headquarters. In their wake, the students, about half of the students, the normally about 1,500 students here at Reseda Charter High School, have been pared down to about 600 or 700, and they're doing different college prep activities. They're playing basketball in the gym. There's, quite a few students on their phones watching videos, it looks like, and they don't certainly look like educational videos.
Students are sort of making the best of the situation. But the principal here says, you know, we're teachers first, you know, even the administrators that are present, and they are certainly trying to make the best of the situation.
Right.
Do some work like on college applications and college prep that they'd have to get pulled out of core classes for. And they're trying to make the best of this time.
Kyle, thanks so much. And let's quickly check with Priska Neely, downtown L.A. She's with the Marchers UTLA strikers today. Have they arrived at the district headquarters yet, Priska?
Not yet. This is a really, really large crowd. I'm finally at the end of the line here. Turned onto 2nd Street from Spring Street, and there's a line of police cars following along. But it's still a long block. There's still several blocks away.
Quite a ways to go. All right, stay dry and be careful as you make that walk along with the teachers who are striking today, day one of the L.A. Unified Strike. Thanks so much for joining us on Air Talk. Just a reminder, that special broadcast for KPCC listeners only at 2 this afternoon of 1A with Joshua Johnson and Fresh Air coming up next right here on 89.3. From all of us, have a very good afternoon.